shell shock. And so they were giving me dope.
During World War II?
He said, that's when I got started. He said, you didn't know it, but that's, since then, he says, I've been using it. I said, oh, no wonder money wasn't coming in. And he admitted himself that the doctors, he says, gave it to me. He said, all those boys that were shell-shocked, he says, and boys that were wounded, that's all we got was dope to kill the pain. That's all we can get out in the field.
Did you ever think about wanting to get married again after that?
No. No, I just heard that. Not that I was too old, but I was thinking about my future. I was thinking about retiring, relaxing, my mother and I alone together. I always had my mother with me. We were very, very close. To this day, I was going over to the convalescent to feed her 3 times a day until a doctor stopped me. And then this doctor knew me, went to my doctor, and my doctor got a hold of me. So, but my mother and I were very, very close. And I always thought about retiring, and her and I traveled. I always had good cars. I always managed to have good cars after I started working and kept them up nice. And weekends when she felt like going to San Francisco, because I had my son and he got messed up when he was sent over there. I was very sorry it happened.
To San Francisco?
Uh-huh. Him and 3 boys. They were small, but they sent them to Preston. So my mother and I would make trips twice a month over there after work. And we had a good time going up there because we stopped and ate and saw different things. Her and I had the same hobbies, I think. She loved birds and flowers, and I did too. And her ambition was having a pretty yard and a nice clean home. That was her ambition. She'd get up at 5 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the morning. She'd break all the leaves because our home is still in Hawaiian Gardens. I got to rent it out. Full of trees, like I told you, all kinds of trees. She'd break all those leaves in the morning and sprinkle it, and that dirt, that sand smell so nice. And the flowers and the birds singing, that was her and my hobby. So just cleanness. She was a very, very clean woman. To this day, the nurses tell me, at her age, 99 years old, can be that clean. She will not dirty the bed. And if she happened to wet herself, she'll cry. And it won't be a day that if she missed the day that they don't give her a bath, she's starting pulling the nurse to the bathroom, to the shower. So I always had in my mind, I had a good time retiring and just travel and go different places, which I never had time. I landed in the hospital and that was it.
What kinds of things did you want for your children?
Oh, I wanted everything, the best for everything. When they started going to high school here at Salter, they always thought that I had money, I guess. They wanted to be dressed just like a dairyman family, when you have people that got money. And I was Mrs. Jones, so I went up to Roberts, which is a very expensive store at that time, for the boy and for the girls. I had credit for them. If they behaved themselves, twice a month they had a new outfit. The boy Levi's and his shirt. They had nice shoes. So when they got into the 30 in high school, they wanted a car. They didn't want to go in the bus anymore. Got them a car. I always managed to have them to have an education, which the 3 of them did have an education. I always wanted something the best for them, and not to be ashamed of themselves. And I always told them what they were, and that we would come from a very poor family, and not to make fun of somebody else that didn't have what you kids have. Maybe the family never had the opportunity to work like I did, and never hate each other. One thing I actually never hate or talk about nobody. That was my ambition. I wanted something good for them all the time. which we didn't have a chance in time of depression. But my kids were well dressed and well behaved. I wasn't ashamed to take them out looking. Until this accident that happened to this boy. They always say when you're on the honey, you get stuck, so I guess he did. I don't say he was perfect, because all boys, you at home you think they're perfect. When they're out, you don't know what they're doing. So they got into a good one over there, and he started a rumor. He got mad at his principal. He said, "Mom, I'm going to get in with that principal." I said, "Nah, you better behave yourself so you can get good grades and get out of there. Maybe make sure you have another principal." So he started a rumor about the principal was in a bar drinking with one of the teachers. Well, that rumor went so far, it went to clip to Los Angeles. So the principal came and talked to me. And that's when they sent him to Preston over that.
Because he started that rumor?
Uh-huh. Because, you know, a teacher is not allowed to go to bars. Especially with another, with a teacher, and being a principal. And how do we know whether the principal had a wife or not? So I couldn't complain. I couldn't do nothing. And I wasn't going to do it because I was going to teach him a lesson. I could have, but I didn't.
What is Preston like?
It was a school. It was a detention school. They made them go to school. They made them work. And if they behaved, they could have company. If they didn't behave, they couldn't have no company. He stayed there 2 years. But I used to make that trip every month, twice a month.
What did he do then when he got out?
Work.
Yeah.
Stayed away. No, he stayed by himself. He doesn't live there. He's 42 years old now. This happened when he was about 50.
Did he marry?
No, never. Just my two girls I married. And the very nice boy. The one I live with, the one in San Diego.
Did either of your daughters ever work?
No. None of them. They worked at home and they didn't work when they come here. My son-in-law, this one here, won't allow his wife to cook on Saturday. Saturday and Sunday is her day. And he takes us out Friday night to eat. And they never leave me home. They want me to tag right after them. He's very good. I couldn't have a better son-in-law. Even when they go on vacation, they want me to go with them, which a lot of times I don't want to go. I don't want to tag after them. And I see they have company. Well, with their young, if their wife's over there, and I know them, I'll say hello and say a word or two so it won't look bad, and then I'll get up and walk to my bedroom. Well, I have my bedroom and my television in, lay down and watch television. But I don't interfere with them. Unless they call me, they want me to hear it, they'll tell me. If they don't, don't bother me at all. I just keep on walking and nothing had happened. Mm-hmm. My mother was that way too. I just feel he's so good to me that he won't even turn unless I'm in the tank. Mm-hmm. He took his son out of the bedroom and saw him sleeping on the floor. She's raising two kids in my house. You couldn't find a better son-in-law. Mm-hmm. Mm-mm. And Valentine's, he'll bring me a heart with a bunch of candy. Christmas, they give me the best Christmas presents you ever seen. The both of them. Even my grandson, that boy never had to say a word, never even answer me back. Mm-hmm. Anything I say, and the little girl. Even the ones in San Diego, well, I wasn't very close to the ones in San Diego because, like I say, I always worked. And this one lives so close by. And they have a bar in front of Navy Hospital here in Carson. So most of the time at night, well, she would go and handle the money to bring home. Well, she'd bring me when he was a little kid to the house. Mm-hmm. So I was very close to these kids and to that one over there. Because in San Diego, very seldom went. Unless she got sick or when the kids got sick or needed my help, I'd go. Because I'm always working. I was always working too. Because I never felt like they were supposed to help me. I never want to ask help from them. To this day, I always told them I didn't want to come and live with them. But they didn't want me to stay by myself. The house is too big. and by myself, Hawaiian Garden is rough. But I know the kids would never hurt me. But like she says, somebody else could come in. But he is wonderful. He's a wonderful man. He's always trying to get everything that she wants, fix everything up for her. Now she wants a den in the bedroom upstairs. He's going to start doing it. Anything she wants. She has a credit card, she'll go any place and buy anything. And he won't sell it, no matter how much he pays for it. But he knows how to save money. So much goes away with her. And then we budget to eat, and then she's a very good cook. With any of those things, she makes a good meal. And the other one, that's true. That I'm not too close to. I am, her and I were very close, mother, daughter. But since she got married, and my son-in-law, his money went to his head. And now he's turned into an alcoholic. And she called me here one day and told me about, she was thinking about leaving him. And I said, oh, that's one thing I don't want to know nothing about. You do what you want to do. Think about it before you do it. I said, it's a step that you can't go backwards afterwards. Once you spill milk, it's spilled. And well, how about you? I said, my troubles are my troubles. I said, I never came and told you that. Why? I said, I always told you to love your dad. Your dad is. I never put a hate on him. Told him. But I've never been so close. And now that the kids are all, she has 9 children, they're all in the service. The girls and boys are all in the Air Force. One just came from Spain. He was 3 years in Spain. And I had another granddaughter. It's in the Air Force too. The last letter she wrote to me, she says, you know, I don't do nothing no more, girl, but give orders. And she said, and I won't have much to go now. She said, about 5 years more and I'll be out of this place. And she made her mother sign in. But all her children in the Air Force. So she has a pretty good crew. Mm-hmm. Crews and boys. Crystal, she says she climbed telephone poles. Life wire, she says she left to do that kind of work. And she, one of them's right now in Marchfield, just came back from back east. But like I say, I've never been too close to them. They write to me and I'll write to them, but I'm not very close to them.
What kind of work does your son do?
He's a truck driver. Mm-hmm. He's on his own, he goes here and there. He's single, except the 2 girls. I hear from him when he needs help. If he doesn't need my help, he's all right.
Tell me what menopause was like for you.
Well, when my boy was born, I had surgery. So I didn't notice it. Just everything stopped right there. I never had hot flushes. No faintness, nothing. Everything was normal.
When the baby was born?
I was operated right away. After he was up, I was born, I think the following week, operated for tumors. I had to, they said it was cancer tumors, and I had to remove all my feelings. So it didn't bother me at all. It was just normal. I stopped ministering right there, and I didn't feel nothing. A lot of people hear, oh, hot flushing, I put the windows up at the plant. I hear about taking their shirt, sweaters off, and everything. I look up at my head. They go, didn't you go through that? I said, no, you're lucky. And I'd be just sweating, heads off. No one would be taking Valium, no one would be taking a pill. I never did. I didn't know what sickness was until my last 3 years. I always worked, I never was sick.
Is that when your heart trouble began?
In my lungs. I went away 139. And from, I guess, around 60s, I started noticing my lungs. But I was catching colds all the time. But they never told me it was, well, I guess they didn't know. They never told me whether it was pneumonia it's only the flu, you got a cold. Wear a sweater, and they give you a vitamin shot, and I get over it, and then before you know it, I catch another cold. I said, well, there's something wrong with me. So here lately, I was listening to the, reading in the paper, and then when they wrote to me about the white line, I thought, they, I started reading that, and I said, well, I got the same symptoms, I got that in that white line. Like breathing, tiredness, can't sleep, can't eat, losing weight. If I hear the airplane like real, coming real low, it shakes me. So I started thinking, how can I find out it? And then I read the last paper they wrote to me from the university, told me to check on my sputum. Every time I cough, if it was yellow, to be sure. And so then they gave me this lawyer, I think she was from the university. And I called her and I talked to her, and she sent me to a doctor. That doctor told her that's what I had. UCLA doctors said the same thing, but they never told me. It was on the paperwork. And this lawyer, when she asked for all these, all my records, because they asked me what hospitals I was in, I said, well, I started from Bellflower Hospital, and I went to Cerritos Hospital, I went to Community Hospital in Long Beach, I was in Woodruff, I was in Paramount General, I was in UCLA. I said, all these doctors would write down. But they never told me, all they said, I had lung trouble. I had lung trouble. And but when I started looking at the reading there about my sputum and the way how I felt weak and losing weight, I said, there's something wrong. Definitely something wrong with me. So I called that lawyer that they sent me a card. I needed a lawyer or needed help to get in touch with this lawyer. So I went and talked to her. And she said, she started asking me questions, and I told her everything I felt. She says, how would you go to a state doctor if I send you? I said, I'll go to any doctor to find out what it's really doing, so I can find the cure for it. She said, well, there's not much of a cure for it right now. We don't know nothing about that yet. But she says, I will send you. So she sent me to Wilshire in Los Angeles, and I went to that doctor. And he told me, he says, you know, you're a very sick woman. I said, oh? I said, oh, I thought I had heart trouble. He says, oh, no. He said, do you know that your lungs affected your heart? And I said, well, what is that? But he didn't come out and tell me it was white lung. Uh-uh. He says, if I was you, I'd keep on seeing that attorney that told you to come over. And if you catch cold, you say, which is a cold, don't wait. Please don't wait. He says, go to a doctor. But he never told me it was this white line. And I've noticed this last doctor that my doctor that saw me says, Alicia says, you know, I'm stung with you. He said, I'm a specialist. I'm not internal. And he says, and all your x-rays, it shows a scar. Metal. But he didn't call it white line, just a cold. So I took it up with this lawyer, and the lawyer said, the lawyer got to call the Douglas. So they call an attorney from Douglas. So he got a hold of me a week before I went to the hospital, and he started asking me questions, and he said, well, when did you notice this? I said, well, I was working, and I noticed I was catching a cold. And then when they opened those doors to put the planes out, a lot of times they used to leave them open because the planes would be right in the middle of the doors or kind of the lights or something. You feel that draft right through you, and that draft would pick up all that dust. I always wear a hat or wear a sweater. Or if it got too cold at night, most of the time I worked at night, I would always try and have a little jacket because I always seemed to be, it was my luck to work right in the draft. or right inside of a fuselage where it was all closed in, where it was all that dust, and they had those blowers. And like me catching a cold all the time, I was always managed to have a sweater. And they used to make fun at me. Mr. Brown looked colorful. He said, "Ah, Alicia, I know you from way back." And I said, "What? That sweater you have." He says, "Are you cold, really cold?" I said, "I'm afraid to catch cold." So I was always catching cold. So when I went in there for my retirement, asked them I was going to retire because I knew I couldn't make it. The lady that at the office that was fixing my papers says, "Would you like to go upstairs on building 13 and go get your check?" I said, "I couldn't walk up there." So she said, "I'll walk with you." I just walked out of the office with her, and that's how I was out. She said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "I can't breathe." Like, "I can't." She said, "Well," she says, "we better mail you the check because you can't make it." So she brought me back, and we sat in the office and brought me some water. And she says, "I see what you mean now. That, yeah, you're too weak." But she didn't even know, and I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. But that's the reason why I retired. I didn't want to retire. But my back, I knew I couldn't do it on account of my back. This leg wouldn't help me to walk very straight. I can bend it, but not too fast like this other one. Because I had surgery. And then I noticed I was getting weaker and weaker. And I'm still getting weaker. Not really. They weighed me the other day, a doctor did. I weighed 98 pounds. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, my Lord," he said, "what are you doing? Are you eating?" I said, "I'm eating, but I don't know where the food's going." "Are you eating the right diet food that I told you?" And I said, "I am, doctor. I said, but I can't eat too much. I don't have an appetite." And then he can give me vitamins and give me stuff to take till so I can... I have an appetite, that won't help me. And it feels like I have something heavy, that my chest and my back are touching together. That's how I feel all the time. At night I have to have two pillows, and I call it a half because it's a little bitter when my aunt made me. And I have to put my pillows on my shoulder, up that way, mostly sitting down to sleep, where I can't breathe. But even as hard as I, as sick as I am, if I had to live my life again, I'd go all through this because I enjoyed my work. And I can say about Douglas, that's one company. I was sent to different companies to work for Douglas. And Douglas was the only company that ever treated women right. When they thought it was too heavy of a job, well, Barbie and I, or Kay Holloway, or Betty Murphy, we never complained. At that time, like I say, I was husky, and they are husky. You met them yourself. Betty is. I haven't seen her lately, but the last time I saw her, she was kind of chubby. We never complained. No matter how hard of a job it was, we never, never complained. But when they knew that a woman couldn't do that kind of job, they'd give them something that they could do. And very few women were fired from Douglas. They were very, still to this day, I said that I covered one of the best. They treated the women right, and the men also, not only the women. And they had the water always. The place was clean. We had a cord sweep that dust and everything when we got through working. But it was always clean. All that dust, we were breathing it because we were right in the middle of it. And then the fans that they had inside the ships, because the boys would get awful hot. I was always cold, but then they would make holes in the hose to have air inside there, especially when we were working in the nose, which is very, very close. There was about six of us, we had to lay down to work in there, because when you had they had floors, what we call stations. Now, on the bottom, they would have a floor which a crew can be working down there, and then they had some boards or stand, and then we'd be working in the middle, and there'd be another board and stand for another one to work on top. And a lot of times in between there, where I had to work, I had to lay down, because, they used to put me in there because I was the skinniest one, I would say. And they said that I had, my hands would fit any place. So I would always get that kind of a work. Putting bolts or drilling and nailing in there and then cleaning up after it. And taking all those blankets. We had to throw those blankets to lay in there. And it just seemed that it was very close at that time. I did take my little sweater, but I always had it kept it in my toolbox. And to me, it was rough. A lot of spots were real rough, especially when I had to work inside the wings. The fume of the MAK, which is very strong, I would come out and take a breath, a deep breath, or come right back and get in there and finish my work. Or the paint. The paint had a very funny smell. It was that yellow paint, so it won't get corrosious. When you have a little scratch or something, we kind of clean it up real, real good and call the inspector and the inspector buy it so it wouldn't be a crack. And then we had to paint it. So it wouldn't get corrosive. A lot of times we had plastic little bottles. Sometimes when we didn't have plastic, they'd give us a little like tuna cans to put the paint. And we had all that stuff inside the wings, inside the ships, which is, you can have that fume all the time, that little smell. But they were very, very good. To me, they were very good. I don't care. A lot of foremans. I had colored and I had assistant foreman. Now, general foremans, I only had three. The assistant foremans, they used to change them so that people wouldn't get acquainted with them, I guess. And then they changed the leads. So we had quite a bit of leads and quite a bit of foremen. But assistant foreman. General foreman, I only had three all the time I was there.
Were there very many women assistant foremans?
Only one that I knew, which was Mrs. White. She was she lived in Orange. She became assistant foreman in, I think it was in the 60s when the women, 65 and 67, when the women become foremen. But during the war, no. All men. They had a lot of women for inspectors. But they would have always an inspector. They would always have to have lead inspectors to come and check the inspector's work. And then the inspectors' leads were, the general foreman would come and check it. And then the general foreman, the assistant foreman. The general foreman would come and check the assistant foreman. And each of us had a stamp. They had to be stamped so they knew where that work, who done that work, and who checked it. So when the engineering would come and check it, and they thought it was all right, then they okayed it. Otherwise, they'd go right way back to who started the work. We had a stamp for that. So now that you hear about these planes going down and everything, during the war, we didn't see that. We had a man on work, and I blame it on now on to a lot of them that too much play, no work. Because during the war, we always thought, what if one of my brothers on that ship? What if one of the neighbors that was, we always thought about somebody that was in those ships that were going over there. And one time I put my name on a wing, and my address and my phone number. We done it just for the fun of it. We didn't mark it on it. We just left a little note on the paper. Marine wrote to me. He found it. He went there to do something to repair and found that note and wrote to me. And gave me thanks for the good ship it was and all that. And the girl said, well, what did you get? I said, I want to show you something. Really, that note I left? Yeah. What happened to that note? I said, look I got from that note. Oh, you crazy thing. She laughed over that note. And that boy, afterwards, he came to San Diego, and do you know he came here to Los Angeles to meet me?
That's nice.
And he was in the Marines, and he was in the, water canal. Nothing. You're crazy. They didn't believe when I told my, when the ship went out, I said, you know that ship? And there's an Odeon there. What did you do? I said, after the inspectors got through, I said, and they were going to close the wing, I said, I stuck a note in there and taped it.